Well, hey, everybody, welcome to episode 25 of the Ankeny Fanatic Weekly Podcast. As always, it is brought to you by the Ankeny office of Iowa Realty. They are located at 1802 Southeast Delaware, suite number 103. Iowa Realty is the proud sponsor of Ankeny Fanatic. They have 75 agents specializing in residential, commercial, farm, and land properties. Well, hope everybody had a nice Thanksgiving. Well, it's the day after Thanksgiving now, and we thought we'd take an opportunity today to talk to a couple of former Ankeny athletes who are home for the holidays. In a little while, we'll be talking to Grinnell College tennis player Brenda Guan, but right now we want to bring in our first guest. He is a former Ankeny football star. He is now a sophomore quarterback on the Central College football team. He was recently named to the American Rivers All-Conference first team. He is Blaine Hawkins. Blaine, thanks for coming in today. How you doing?
Very good, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you bet. Well, congratulations on another outstanding season. You guys posted an 8-2 record. You went 6-2 and placed second in the conference. You know, were you pretty happy with the way things went this year?
I think overall the year can be considered a success for us. We had a lot of young guys step up and really improve throughout the year, but overall our goal was a conference championship and we didn't get that done, so it's kind of a failure in that way, but it gives us something to really look forward to working for in the offseason. So, yeah.
Well, you guys got up to a 7-0 start before losing at Wartburg on October 20th. And according to your sports information director, Larry Happel, there, he told me that you got hurt in the first quarter of that game and you missed all of the October 27th game against Coe as well. And to quote Larry, he said, quote, "To say that Blaine makes an impact on our team is an understatement. He went down at Wartburg on a 21-yard run in which he thinks he would have scored had he not fallen down. You guys trailed 6-3 at the time, and that would have made it 10-6. Instead, without you, Central kicked a field goal on that possession. It was 6-6 at the end of the quarter. And you guys were down 47-6 at the end of the third quarter. So Wartburg went on to win 47-20. You know, do you think the game might have turned out differently if you hadn't gotten hurt?
I like to think so, but at the same time, I won't play the guessing game like that. So obviously that was really disappointing for me and as a team. That game just hurts a lot just to think back on it. But I was just grateful that, you know, I didn't have too bad of an injury to my knee and I was able to come back and still be able to play the last game of the year with my teammates. So
what exactly did you do to your knee?
So earlier in the game on a different running play, I got my leg stuck underneath a pile kind of and got bent over the top. So on that, I felt a pop and I tore my medial patellofemoral ligament, which kind of holds your kneecap in place. So then later in the game, like just a drive later, I was running and I felt a pop, like a loud pop in my knee. And so I thought I really did something bad, but turns out I just sublocated like my patella. So my kneecap popped out of place and back in, which made the big pop, but it hurt a lot, but it's not the worst injury it could have been. So I'm grateful for that.
Well, that's good. Well, Larry also told me that your team went 7-3 last year, and two of the three losses came before you took over as the starting quarterback. So basically, with you as the starter, your team has only lost once over the last two seasons, right?
Yep.
Well, that's pretty impressive. You know, that says a lot about your importance to the team, I think.
Oh, thank you.
Well, after your team lost to Coe in overtime, you did come back for the season finale at Loras on November 10th. You know, what would you say percentage-wise your knee was at that point?
I would say probably 75-80%. It felt all right. I'd been doing rehab for the past 3 weeks. We had a bye week in there, so that really helped out, and ordered a knee brace to help kind of hold my kneecap in place to make sure it wouldn't pop out again. I was able to run around a little bit, but not quite as much as I normally like to, but I was just glad I could be out there, and I felt like if I was able to move around and play, I knew I needed to be out there with the guys.
Well, you did help the team overcome a 17-point deficit to win the game 37-34. Your teammate John Alberts kicked an 18-yard field goal with 2 seconds left to win the game. So that must have been a pretty exciting way for you guys to finish the season.
Yes, it was. I think that first or second quarter when we were down 17-0, was like, man, we're just not playing our game right now. You know, we knew those guys that we can move the ball on and we can put up points, and we just weren't getting it done. So we went into halftime. We were losing, I think, by 14 at that point. And we just looked at each other and we're like, you know, we know that's not who we are. That's not who we are. And so in the second half, we just knew we had to come out there and prove otherwise. And I think our defense got some key turnovers, and we were able to take advantage. So it was a pretty special day.
Well, you're obviously at less than full strength, but you still managed to complete 19 of 31 passes for 248 yards and a touchdown. You also ran for 20 yards and another score, you know, despite being limited, you know, mobility-wise. After the game, your coach, Jeff McMartin, had this to say about you. He said, quote, "Blaine gave us everything he had. He's a special player, and having him on the field is a good thing. It would have been easy for him to say, oh, it's the end of the season, I'll get ready for next year. But he wanted to play. He wanted to compete and be with his teammates. You know, that says a lot about him." You know, how does that make you feel when your coach calls you a special player?
You know, it's an honor to Coach Mack to share those words about me. You know, his opinion means a lot to me, and he's held in high esteem by everyone in our program. And, you know, it kind of makes me feel all warm inside when he says that about me, but it's very nice of him.
Well, how would you say that the Central offense compares to the one that you ran at Ankeny? You know, do you guys run like a spread offense too with a lot of tempo?
Yeah, we try to pick up the pace a lot and spread out the defense. I would say it's pretty similar. The learning curve wasn't too steep for me coming in from Ankeny. Some zone read type stuff as well as a lot of quick passing game, and I think really plays to my strengths, and that was kind of one of the things that I was looking at when I chose Central. I realized it would be a good place for me to fit in.
Well, your team also had an exciting 17-16 win over rival Simpson on October 13th, and in that game, your team drove for the winning touchdown in the final 2 minutes. I read where you converted a critical 4th and 10 to keep the drive alive, and then I guess you made an amazing play on the winning touchdown. Can you kind of describe what happened on that play?
Yep. On that play, I think it was first or second down, but we were probably at the 16-yard line with 30 seconds left, and the play we had called, we went 5 wide receivers out, so I dropped back and I was looking for my first read and he wasn't there, and then I kind of got off him to the second read. By that point, I was kind of just, it was kind of a scramble play, so I was looking around and then I took off to run to my left, and as I was running to my left, I thought about tucking it to run, and then out of the corner of my eye, I saw our tight end, Ross Norum, and he had kind of leaked open in the back of the end zone, so I just turned and threw it on the run, and he made a nice catch there, so it was an awesome feeling.
Well, the way I read it, you had to throw it across your body, right?
Yeah, well, I was running to my left, and then I kind of had to turn and awkwardly throw it back to the right. And it was, it's one of those throws the coaches tell you never to make, but it worked out good that time.
Oh, well, that's awesome. Well, after that game, your coach said, quote, "You want to have people who have short memories when they make mistakes, and Blaine is really good about playing the next play and not living in the past, whether it was good or bad. Give him a lot of credit. He is really good at extending plays, and he did that again. There were a lot of times where something wasn't open, and he was able to kind of make something happen. We got some timely plays when we needed them. He's a playmaker, and I wouldn't trade him." So do you have a lot of confidence, that you can make something out of nothing when a play breaks down?
Yep, I think that's one of my biggest strengths as a player. I'm not super tall. I'm not the fastest. I'm not the strongest. But I feel like making smart decisions and then improvising plays is one of my strongest parts of my game. So, if a play's not going right or the first thing isn't there, I feel like I'm pretty comfortable making something happen after that.
Well, I know Central and Simpson have been longtime rivals going back to the days of the Iowa Conference. Is Simpson, would you say, still your biggest rival, or is Wartburg, because of their recent success, have they kind of become your biggest rival?
I think historically Simpson's been a pretty big rival of Central's for sure, and it's definitely a game that, it means a little extra. Each team brings the intensity a little bit more. But as far as just Wartburg's just been really dominant recently in the conference, so each game, that's the game, this year we were like, if we win that game, that's our chance to win the conference. And obviously we didn't get that done. And I'm sure next year we're going to be in the same spot where it goes through Wartburg. We have to beat them to win the conference normally. So, yeah.
Well, you finished the season with some pretty impressive numbers. You ranked 8th in NCAA Division III in completion percentage with a school record 67.1%. And you were 23rd in passing efficiency. And despite missing action in 2 games, you threw for nearly 1,900 yards, the 5th best total in school history, and had 17 touchdown passes, the 7th most in school history. You must be pretty proud of those statistics.
Yeah, I'd say, it's cool to look back at the end of the year and see those stats, but during the year, we don't think about it too much. It's just thinking about moving on to the next game and just executing each play. And I know if we execute each play, then at the end of the year, the statistics will be what they are, but it'll be good, I guess.
Well, in just 2 seasons now, you already rank 7th in school history with 35 career touchdown passes and 10th in career completions and passing yards. Now, have you looked at the record book at all to see, what you have to do in order to climb those charts a little higher?
No, not too much. I've seen a few of the names up there, and I know, it's just an honor to be on the same list as some of those guys. I've been on some really good Central teams and have put up a lot of points, so it's cool to see my name up there with them, but I haven't looked into it too much.
Well, you obviously had a great career at Ankeny High School as well. Do you think playing in the CIML against the competition that you faced, helped prepare you for playing at the next level?
Most definitely. I know a lot of my teammates at Central, they're from some smaller schools, even some 8-man football, and I know the learning curve for them is definitely a lot steeper than it was for me. In the CIML, playing pretty good teams week in, week out for the most part, and competition's pretty high, and a lot of those guys go on to play college football, so it made the transition not quite as difficult for me as for a lot of the other guys.
Well, I know that your team will return 15 starters next season. Are you excited about the prospects for next year?
Yep, I definitely am. I think, my class, the sophomore class, had a lot of guys be able to play this year, and I think even more that will step up next year, and it's just another off season of growth will help us get just bigger, stronger, and faster, and I think, next season is going to be an exciting one for us for sure.
Obviously, one of the goals is to get back into the D3 playoffs, right? Because it's been a few years for Central, hasn't it?
Yep, I think 2009 was the last time, and in our current situation, there are a few at-large bids, but we have to win the conference if we want to make the playoffs. So.
All right. Well, another thing I wanted to ask you about, is the health risk of playing football. We discussed the head trauma issue on our podcast a few weeks ago with Joel Lanning and Senator Jack Whitfer. And I don't know if you happened to see on Sunday or not, but on the 60 Minutes, they had a story about former NFL player Tim Green and his battle with ALS. Did you happen to see that?
I did not see that.
Well, anyway, Tim has enjoyed a successful broadcasting career after his NFL days ended, and He's also written nearly 40 books, and he's still able to write, even though his physical condition has deteriorated somewhat. You know, and obviously you've been banged up sometimes, you know, throughout your career. You know, do you have any concerns at all about the long-term risks, you know, of playing football?
You know, a little bit. I think a lot of us, me and my teammates, you know, we've talked about it with each other in the dorm rooms, and are like, you know, what are we doing out there? Are we hurting ourselves? Are we going out there every day and playing? But I think overall what we think is that, I mean, Central has prepared us. They've given us a lot of nice equipment. I have a Vices helmet, which is like what you see Patrick Mahomes wearing out there, and it's like one of the kind of on the cutting edge of helmets. And I think they do the most to protect us. Our coaches don't have us hitting every day. We hardly ever tackle each other. So I think that part of the game, you recognize the coaches are trying to keep us safe too. And I think just for me personally, I look at it as the stuff I'm gaining by playing football, the relationships, the fun I'm having, it's all the life skills I'm learning. It's just, it's all worth it, I think, for the most part. And that's how I look at it. Obviously, if I had serious, you know, head trauma multiple times, I'd think about it again. I'd have to reevaluate, but I haven't had that yet. So, yeah.
Well, as a quarterback, you obviously take some blows. You know, have you ever had a concussion?
No, I have not. So
you're lucky then.
Yep, knock on wood.
Well, you've obviously proven that you can play at this level. Have you given any thought? I know it's a long, long time down the road, but have you thought about trying to pursue playing, you know, beyond college time?
I've thought about it a little bit. Actually, this past May, our team was lucky enough to take a trip to Europe. We got to go play a game against the Schwerkow Raiders of the Austrian Football League. So it was kind of a fun experience to go with my teammates, and we played them over there. And I have a couple coaches who have played in Europe, and just for a year or two, but they said it was really awesome just living over there. And so it's something I've thought about, but not too heavily. But I'm also thinking about studying abroad next year. So after going abroad, I'll have a better idea of what that's like, and maybe it'd be something to do for a year or two, just as something to gain that experience.
All right. Well, I know you told me earlier that you're busy watching football today. We're taping this actually during halftime of the Iowa-Nebraska game. Do you enjoy watching, you know, some of those Division I players play, like guys like Riley Moss and Jake Penninger that you played against in high school?
Yeah, it's definitely cool seeing some guys that I've played against. I know some guys from Valley are playing too in the Big Ten. It's fun to see guys that you've played against and competed against out there. And, you know, I think a lot of them are having success, so that's awesome for them.
And like I mentioned earlier, you know, you've proven that you can play at the D3 level. You know, do you think sometimes, you know, do you wonder, you know, hey, could I play it, you know, at a higher level?
You know, I think about it sometimes, like, what would I be like if I was out there? But at the same time, you know, I'm really happy at Central College. I've made a lot of great relationships with my teammates, and there's nothing that would make me want to leave. So I don't worry about it too much.
And what are you studying there, Blaine?
I've just decided to study economics.
Okay. Do you know what you want to do with that degree when you graduate?
I'm still working on that. So I just figured out the major, so I guess that's the first step.
Well, you got plenty of time to figure that out, right?
Yep.
Well, thanks a lot for coming in today, Blaine. Hope you enjoy the rest of your holiday weekend.
Oh, thank you very much, Dan.
You bet. All right, you're listening to the Ankeny Fanatic Weekly Podcast, sponsored by Iowa Realty. The Ankeny office at Iowa Realty will close in excess of $250 million in real estate in 2018. Their agents represent over 20 new construction builders and communities all over the metro. With interest rates at historic lows, would you like to know what your home is worth in today's market? If so, you can give them a call at 453-5800. That number again is 453-5800. Well, right now we want to bring in our second guest. She's a former standout tennis player at Ankeny Centennial. She's now a junior and a co-captain on the Grinnell College women's tennis team. She is Brenda Guan. Brenda, thanks for coming in. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you bet. Well, we're going to tackle a serious subject with Brenda here in a little bit. But first, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your tennis season. I see you had a 9-4 record in singles and a 16-4 mark in doubles this fall. Were you pretty happy with the way the season went for you?
Yes and no. I think I had some... I'm particularly proud of that doubles record. We had some very good wins against teams that we really weren't supposed to beat. So me and my partner, we played well. She came in without a lot of experience in doubles, so I was really proud of the way that we could come out and just get better as the season went on. For singles, it was a bit tougher for me because I was struggling with an injury towards the end of the season, and we have this big individual tournament towards the end of the season, and I was the number one seed at the tournament, and I ended up having to pull out of the final. So that was a very tough process to go through, I suppose. But
what kind of injury did you have?
What kind of injury did I not have? I was struggling with a shoulder injury, and towards the end of the season, I also had a back injury, and so in the middle of the final match, I took a hard fall going for a high ball, and I just couldn't get back up, couldn't walk anymore. So that was tough, but I'm better now after having a month off and not doing much. So.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
You actually played tennis way back in the day at Ankeny High School. I remember those days. You could get hurt once in a while.
So. Oh yeah. It was tough to play for the whole season without having any major issues. So I'm very thankful for that.
Well, now I was looking at the website there at Grinnell, and I noticed you guys play both a spring and a fall season, right?
Yes, we do.
So are both seasons kind of equal, or is one more the main season than the other?
I think tennis is different at Grinnell in how we do have two seasons, and we look at the fall season with sort of our main season. It is the conference season. We play everybody in our conference, and we go for the conference title, but I think the spring season is also important that we get a chance to play non-conference people, and so we usually have tougher matches. We do have that big spring break trip that we go to Florida, and we play very good teams. Over the years, we've become more competitive in those matches, and so that's exciting to see. And at the end of the spring season, we have what we call the regional tournament. We play a team tournament with the top four teams in our conference from the fall. And we play in the winter of that tournament gets to go to the NCAA national tournament. So.
Oh, okay.
So they're kind of tied together. They're both very big seasons, both very long. So,
well, I know in high school you had to deal with some crazy weather, you know, sometimes in the spring. You know, is the weather generally a little bit better in the fall then for you?
I like it better, to be honest. I always wish that high school season was in the fall. It's like a lot less windier in the fall, that's for sure.
Less rain too, I would think.
Oh, for sure, yeah. But also just in college, you have more access to indoor courts. So, I mean, depending on how your coach is feeling that day, I suppose you could still deal with really cold weather. We go to Minnesota sometimes, and this past fall we went there and it was like 40 degrees outside, and I was still playing out there. It was very windy, but yeah, for sure, playing in high school in the spring was it's helped a lot with me to deal with, because I have teammates from states where they have very mild, very nice weather. They come up here to play in Iowa, and they don't know what to do with themselves.
Oh, I'll bet. Well, how did you become a co-captain? Were you named by the coach, or was that voted on by the players?
Usually our coach kind of just tells everybody you get two votes. Just tell me why you're going to vote for them as captain. So that's sort of nominated by your teammates. I was very surprised to be nominated. I'm only a junior on the team, but my co-captain Lily, she's the lone senior. So I fully expected her to be captain. I voted for her, but I was very honored to be voted for by my younger teammates. Hoping to be a good example to them, I guess.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you take some pride in that. So do you try to be a leader then for the younger girls?
I try. I try to lead more by example. I'm not very outspoken in a very peppy, motivating sort of way.
Sure.
But, yeah, I do try to lead by example. I hope I'm doing an okay job at that. Yeah.
How would you describe the competition at the Division III level? Was that a big step up for you coming from the CIML in high school?
Yes, and I think it's the Division III in the NCAA is it's interesting because we don't get any scholarships to play. It's purely based on how much you love the game, and lots of players. You still see very tough, very good competition, and those people are clearly the people who obviously there are some people who could have gone D1, but wanted to focus on academics, wanted to get a good education, and but also just spend time playing tennis. And I think that the competition just really takes a step up in that sort of regard, because you're playing everybody that is playing tennis really with their free time, and they're sacrificing a lot to play tennis. So. Yeah, I would say it's a lot tougher mentally and physically to play people like that. You got to really want it sometimes. So, yeah.
Well, of course, Grinnell College is one of the best academic schools in Iowa. Has it been difficult for you to juggle your academic and athletic responsibilities?
Yeah, it's been tough. I think the jump from high school to Grinnell was tough for me because I wasn't asked a lot in high school, and nobody really challenged me in high school. And so going into Grinnell, where there's a lot asked of you, and you're just working your butt off to, you know, to keep up in classes, to perform well in classes, and to, you know, like, tennis is really just a part-time job. It really is, and you're not being paid for it. So you gotta really, get after. You gotta really want it. So just to not be able to start your homework until 7 p.m. it's like a big sacrifice to make for some of us. I mean, when you got 6-7 hours of readings to do every night. So I think, yeah, it was different, but I think I like it better. It's more engaging, it's more challenging, and that's really what I wanted out of Grinnell. I'm very thankful that they could have me. My mom always makes fun of me for being able to get in there, because when they first accepted me, she made fun of me. She's like, I'm pretty sure this is a mistake of some sort. But I'm really proud of the way I've gotten my act together, working hard, and being able to play tennis is just, it's a lot of fun, man. It's a lot of hard work, but, I mean, it's so much fun.
Well, why not the challenge just to even get into Grinnell? Because I know my son looked into Grinnell when he graduated from Centennial, a year ahead of you, I believe, and just the process, you know, that you have to go through to even get into it, I know it's pretty strenuous.
Oh, yeah,
so.
It's a lot.
Well, the main reason I wanted to have you on the podcast today was because of an opinion piece that you wrote for the Des Moines Register about a month ago. It was very well written. It was titled, Your White Privilege is Suffocating Me. So let's dive into, you know, what this piece was about a little bit. Let's start with the incident that sparked your decision to write this piece. Can you kind of tell our audience, you know, what happened to you while you were playing in a match?
So this was at our individual tournament. This was on the Sunday of the tournament when we were playing singles. And I think I've always known that there's this rule about speaking in a foreign language when you're playing your matches, and I've never really been wanting to care about it, just because my coaches usually, even in high school, Coach Pomacek was never very, very harsh to me about it. She never made me feel bad about it. Most of my coaches are just like, hey, just so you know, you could get in trouble for this. And if you do, like, that's up to you. I'm not ever going to punish you for it, that sort of thing. And I've always appreciated that kind of support. But at this tournament, I wasn't having a particularly bad day. I wasn't playing very well that day. That's the honest truth. And it was during the match. Not sure like when it exactly happened, but it was during the changeover, and my coach comes up to me, and I really just thought she was coming up to give me some coaching because I really needed it at that moment. But she comes up to me and she's like, hey, Brenna, just so you know, the next time you speak in a foreign language, you will be assessed a point penalty. That's never happened to me, being penalized for a point. And I think that's a pretty hefty punishment in tennis, just because a point is a lot. You have to fight for every point. And so when she told me that, I immediately understood that was what the ref had relayed to her. And I'd like to point out that I really appreciated the fact that my coach didn't tell me to stop. She didn't tell me to, you know, cut it out. She was just like, if you do this again, this is what's going to happen to you. So
let me interrupt for a second.
Yep.
So do you think somebody complained about it, or do you think it was just the referee?
I think it was just the referee. And later that week, I did go in and have a conversation with my coach about it, and she did show me the rule book. It says that if a player has a loud outburst in a language that the official does not understand, they will be assessed a warning and then a point penalty. And so I was given that warning. And I had two more matches that day, and for the rest of the day, I essentially just couldn't express myself emotionally at all. Every time I'd open my mouth to say something, you know, I'd have to check in my brain, is this going to come out in the right language? Is this going to come out in the right way? And so yeah, it was just a very suffocating process for me because I didn't understand why I was being put in this position for speaking a funny-sounding East Asian language, and the girl on the other team who speaks German is not bothered at all, you know. And so that was a very maddening experience for me. I mean, it's not the first time that's happened to me, but to not know if I had the support of the people around me, my teammates, spectators even, to not know if your coach thinks it's stupid, to not know if, you know, they'd step up for you if you were given that point penalty. I think that was a very infuriating insecurity for me to have, I guess.
Sure.
And so, I mean, I wrote that piece in the back of the bus on our way home that night. I was so mad it just came out. I wish all my papers came out that easily, but yeah, it was tough for me to write though, just because I knew that it would upset a lot of people, and I felt it was more aggressive than how I usually communicate with people, how I usually interact with people in my life. So it was, I admit I had like some troubles approaching my coach about it. Just I didn't know how she would react, and I think that part about it too is very, very frustrating for me, not knowing if I had that kind of support, not knowing if people would be defensive, that sort of thing. So.
Sure. Well, let me read one part of your piece. You wrote, quote, "During tennis matches, I am given to angry bursts of Mandarin. My sisters can attest. I default to Mandarin when I'm angry. I assure you up front, I do not swear. I can accept criticism for yelling, but I will not stand for criticism of my Mandarin," end quote. So you obviously feel like, you know, when you're out on the court, you know, that you should be allowed to express yourself, you know, in whatever language you choose, mm-hmm. as long as you're not swearing, right?
I think so, yeah. And I do understand the trouble of officials in being faced with that sort of situation. And you know, swearing is not is against the rules. You're not allowed to do it in English. You're not allowed to do it. Period. And it's bad sportsmanship. And I understand that. But I think I'm a firm believer in the fact that if all you have is the fact that I'm not speaking in English, it's not enough to punish me because I am. I mean, you don't even have to trust the fact that I'm not swearing. It's just, it's not fair to people like me. And I, you know, I'm not a big fan of the way that I handled myself that day. It's, you know, emotionally sometimes it's, I mean, I do not like when I yell like that. It's a bad sign for me. It's a bad sign of the emotional place that I am in. But and I can take criticism for that. I really can. It's you know, I wish I would have handled myself in a better way that day. But to call me out for what I said, not the way I said it, I think that's the part that I take issue with.
What was the reaction that you got, you know, from your piece coming out then?
It was what I expected is the way I would put it. People close to me, people I know, had very supportive, very affirming reactions to that. But I also I think I had some fun with a friend looking at the comments on the Des Moines Register's post, Facebook post. Lots of those were very negative, very defensive comments, and I didn't take any of them personally. I just thought it was very, it was entertaining for me to go through those, just because I personally think a lot of them are very ignorant, very miss the point,
right,
sort
right.
of thing. And there were some people that I knew and that I shared the article with, but I didn't really necessarily expect a very positive reaction from them either, just based on what I know about them, based on, you know, like pushing them out of their comfort zone a little bit. So those people, I try not to be very aggressive about it. I'm just like, hey, I wrote a piece for the Register. I'd love if you read it. And you know, that was it. There were some people I didn't bother saying, hey, what did you think? Didn't want to put them on the spot like that. So it's not as overwhelmingly positive as some pieces get you, but it was what I expected is how I would say it. But yeah, I'm very grateful that I can just focus on people whose opinions matter to me. So
did you accomplish what you wanted to with it then?
I think so. I think I raised some very important points to my coach, who comes from she admitted to me that she comes from a very insulated environment, insulated background. So she was very grateful for me, and my co-captain Lily, she still talks about it to me all the time, and she's still very concerned about it, and wants to keep talking about it with me and with my teammates and with the athletic department at Grinnell. And I think that's a very that's really all I wanted to do. I really wanted to just start a conversation on my team, and you know, beyond that, I really don't have much control. So, you know, I'm not looking to change anything on a grand scale. I just wanted to, you know, tell the people in my life, this is what's going on. You know, it'd be really nice if you could step up, because I'm very tired of speaking up for myself and fighting for myself against institutions and ways of thinking that I really have no leeway against. So,
well, you also wrote in your piece that you know, when stuff like this happens, that it almost makes you feel like you were white. And you said there's been other instances that have happened to you that, you know, it made you feel like, oh, I wish I was white. You know, that's got to be tough to even have that thought come into your mind, I would think. But
it's a very sad thought to have, and I have it a lot, because on one hand, it's just sad to not be able to, you know, feel like that you're adequate in society. And I think the other part is I feel like that thought itself is very insulting to the culture and the heritage that of my parents and the way that they raised me. And so, I mean, I can't help it when I have that thought. There are lots of things that I run into that make me think that thought. And you know, it's really about just not trying to not have that thought as much anymore. And it's just a sad truth that, you know, if I was white, if I wasn't raised the way I was, life would be a lot more comfortable for me, I think.
Now, for people that don't know you, what is your background? I was reading on the Grinnell College site there about your bio, because you grew up or born in Ames,
mm-hmm,
right? So, I mean, you grew up here your whole life, right?
Right. I was born in Ames. I moved here the summer before my third grade year, and I've lived in Ankeny ever since. And my parents are both from China. They immigrated in 96, I believe. They were students at Iowa State University, and all three of my sisters are born in Ames, born in the same hospital. So the three of us have been, you know, American citizens at birth. And it really is just as, I think, being a second generation immigrant it poses a lot of challenges to you. Lots of people have lots of different opinions about how to reconcile two different competing worlds in your life, but really nobody can fix it for you. And so that's just something you have to grapple with on your own as you grow up.
Sure. Well, I don't want to get into a deep, you know, political discussion, but it's not any secret that the political climate, you know, has gotten a lot more volatile, you know,
yeah,
in the last couple of years. You know, we just had the midterm elections where there were several different races, you know, where one candidate accused another of playing the race card,
mm-hmm,
or whatever. You know, there have been some other disturbing incidents like the one in Charlottesville, you know, a year ago. You know, have you personally, you know, either seen an increase in racism or been victimized by more incidents, you know, in the past couple of years?
I don't think it's an increase in racism. I think if anything in my life, it's been an awakening of the fact that racism still exists. It's just a very, it's under the surface, and it's at a point. It's at a point today where we're in a place like Ankeny, Iowa, you can completely avoid it. You can completely just not know that it exists. And I think that was a majority of my childhood, because I think, to everybody's credit, in the place where I grew up, I never thought of myself as different. I knew there was something different and something weird, but I think that as a child, I learned how to contain it, how to just keep it at home, keep it between me and my parents. But as you grow up and as you get out there, and you, I think the biggest thing that taught me that that racism still exists today is, you know, all of my trips to China. It's weird, because when you go to China, like, you feel like, wow, I finally fit in. Everybody looks like me now, and I am in the majority. But you go there and you find out that you're still different, and people will still treat you differently. And it's a sense that, you know, you're never gonna belong, and you're never gonna be the same. And so, you know, I think that it's always existed. It just hasn't been as in your face and in your obvious as, you know, as obvious examples in the past. And I think that the problems in our society today that occur because of racism, it's just because there's an entire population of Americans who have, you know, gone into adulthood, have built lives for themselves, and they've never had to grapple with it. They've never had to experience it for themselves, and they've never had to see people be hurt by it, because it's just so easy today to just ignore it.
Mm-hmm. Well, this incident that happened on the tennis court obviously inspired you to write this piece, but you also mentioned that there's been other times in your life when you wished you were white, and you don't have to answer this question if you don't want to, but what's maybe the worst type of racism that you've ever had to deal with? Or has there been too many to even to count?
I think the worst kind is, again, the most desolate instances that I've had to deal with this have all been in China, where there have been many instances where I go into a tourist space, and because of my fluency in Chinese, I sound like a native. You know, sometimes I've ignored for other tourists, other Americans, from different places, because, you know, probably just because they're white. And you know, there have been instances where I've, you know, it can be as simple as waiting for food, waiting for customer service, and they ignore you because they see you as, you know, as Chinese, and you're worthless to them because you probably don't have as much money as that white American standing next to you, and so I'm going to give them the better service. It's instances on planes where, you know, I'm sitting next to an Australian and a man from Hong Kong, and, you know, the flight attendant will, you know, give them great customer service in English, and they'll look at me, and they'll be incredibly rude to me in Chinese, and I've been scolded in touristy places for asking for cold water because it supposedly gives you diarrhea, because people in China are used to drinking hot water, and, you know, that's just a cultural difference. And if somebody who looks like me goes up and asks for ice water, the old lady looks at you and be like, "You are going to get sick," and she starts lecturing me about my habits, you know, the reason why they have ice water in those places is to give them to the Americans, give them to the Westerners who are used to drinking ice water, you know, that sort of thing. So it's difficult to be in a space like that where you where there's clearly something very different about you in the way that you act and the way that you talk. I'm very different from Chinese people. And lots of my relatives see that, you know, just the way that I carry myself is extremely different from a Chinese person. But strangers on the street will still look at you and they'll still assume things about you that, you know, are not true. And it really just, it's hard because when, you know, when there's a white person standing next to you that he might not even be an American, you know, for all intents and purposes, he could be Chinese. And you're ignored for that man because he's white, he probably speaks English, speaks a different language anyways, and they assume things about him. And they assume things about you because you look a certain way. And it's tough to go back to a country that you feel like you should belong in. Because, you know, you tried the same thing in America and nobody feels like you belong either. And so it's, you know, just imagine being in elementary school and still trying to figure things out about your life and being faced with different group of people who still don't accept you. I think that's that was probably some of the toughest things to reconcile with. And I don't know if my mom helped or not. She's very much a, you know, these things happen in society, and it's up to you to make peace with it, I suppose. And you know, I know lots of friends whose parents you know, are very aware of these things and don't want their children to, you know, experience these things. And so they'll tell their children to be like, you know, you're going to speak English in China, because if you don't, people will ignore you. And you know, I've always envied those kinds of parents, my friends with those kinds of parents, just because I wanted to get that recognition too. I wanted to be seen as an American. I wanted to show off my perfect American English that, you know, people pay thousands of dollars to copy and to replicate. But my mom was never like that. She never really approved of that kind of behavior because she thought it was, she thought it was something that you had to, you know, deal with on your own level. It's not something that people can fix for you. And so that was extremely difficult. And I, you know, with the amount of times that I went to China and had to deal with that because my mother wouldn't let me broadcast the fact that I was an American, I had to learn it the hard way. And so I think it's even worse in those kinds of places than at home.
That's interesting conversation, Brenda. I would encourage anybody to go to the Register's website and look up her piece. That's Brenda Guan, G-U-A-N, and take a look at it. Might learn a few things. I know I've learned some things here today from Brenda. Going forward, though, as far as tennis goes, you know, do you think anything has been resolved as far as this rule goes? Do you think it'll come up again, or is this just something you're going to have to deal with?
I think this is just something that I'm going to have to deal with. My coach and I had a very nice conversation before I went home for break, before I went into the off season, and she was very supportive of me. And you know, I'm not asking in my article for, you know, for my white peers to stand up for me and to pick a fight for me. You know, it'd be, I won't lie, it'd be nice, but that's not what I'm going for, because I know how uncomfortable that would make some people feel. But, you know, I told my coach, I was like, you know, the only thing that I would really like for you to do is for you to just tell me that you think that this is stupid too. And, you know, just just being able to affirm me verbally in that way, it's priceless. It's to have some solidarity in that. It's I think that's right now that's the easiest thing for someone to do for me, you know. And my coach is very very supportive of me in the fact that she told me she's she didn't tell me to stop. She didn't tell me to, you know, just to speak English, to follow the rules per se. She just told me, she's like, you know, this is something that you can decide for yourself what you want to do. I'm not going to tell you to do anything. And she told me, she said, you know, if you ever get penalized under this rule, I will never punish you. I will never sit you on the bench. And I think, you know, I think that was really the only thing I was going for. I just wanted to be reassured. And my teammates have reassured me since. And I think that's, you know, that's really all that I can ask for going forward. You know, I'm not going to change the way that I express myself. Everybody has their way of expressing themselves emotionally in the heat of the game. And I think that the only thing that I wanted to change was knowing that I would have the support of my team behind me if I was ever penalized under this point. I'm not going to look for a rule change. I just want the people who matter to me to be able to tell me, you know, Brenda, I think this is stupid too. And, you know, if I ever do get penalized in the future, you know, that's not going to deter me. I mean, it's a process, I think, to be able to, you know, control your emotions when you're mad, when you're frustrated, and I'm getting there, but whether or not I get there in time, is, it's an altogether different thing, I think. So going forward, I'm hopeful, I'd say.
Now, do you know, Brenda, if on the professional level, for like the women's tour, do they have any kind of a rule like that? Like if there's foreigners playing at the U.S. Open?
It's much more difficult for professional players to get away with it because the people who preside over their matches speak God knows how many languages. And so I don't think it's as much of a problem on the professional level just because of how global the sport of tennis is on that level.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more of a problem at this level because tennis is a very white sport in America, and I think that in itself makes it very difficult for people to grapple with, you know, people who don't fit the bill like I do. And you know, and there's and I think one of the most frustrating things that I learned throughout this process was that the refs at our matches, they are given a list of curse words in foreign languages to, you know, to look out for. But they're all words in languages like Spanish and French and German and all these European languages. And so when they hear a girl speaking German or when they hear a girl speaking French angrily, as loud as I am, and they don't hear something on this list, you know, the rule says a language that the official does not understand. And technically, now that they have that list, they can say they understand Spanish, French, and German because that's all they care about hearing. And if they don't hear it, then it's fine. But Chinese is not on the list. 1 in 7 people, at least in this world, speak Chinese and is not on that list. And so anything that I say that sounds not Spanish, not French, not German, I'm penalized for it because I just happen to speak the wrong languages. And so I think that it's a very American problem, if I dare say. I don't I mean, you see professional players all the time swearing, and they get punished for it because they're understood. But if they're just talking to themselves, if they're just even ranting. I mean, my favorite player, Novak, he rants all the time in Serbian. He's not punished for it because it's a global sport, and they understand that there's more than one language that is relevant to our lives and to our worlds. And so it's frustrating for me to be able to see that world and be a part of that world, but then be confined into a world where people don't, where Chinese sounds like a funny language to them.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like I'm in an argument all the time when I am, I'm probably just talking to my mom, you know?
Well, if you could get this rule changed, mm-hmm. is that something that you'd like to see, or do you think that would just open up a whole another can of worms? I mean, obviously it would work for you because you say you don't swear regardless of what language you're speaking. So it would work for you. But do you think that would just be too problematic for other players?
I think this is something that my coach brought up to me too. And my answer to her was, yes, there will be people who abuse a rule change. There will be people who abuse that. But this is an instance where I would rather see a guilty man walk free than an innocent man be punished. This is very much one of those instances, and I think that is, you know, we live in a society where innocent people go punished, and everybody think that's okay because as long as we feel like we're getting all the guilty people rounded up, you know. So yes, I agree that. There would be people who abuse that. You know, just like any other rule, there are going to be people who abuse that. But I think that a rule change, if there ever was to be one, it would validate a way that a majority of people live. The majority of the world is multilingual, and we can't keep going around and pretending like speaking English is the way that everybody is, because it's just not true, and it's a very narrow way of looking at the world. It's a very ignorant way of looking at the world, and I think it would go a very long ways to reaffirm the existence of people like me who don't fit that kind of bill. And this world is getting smaller and smaller. It really is. And there are people who have very global minds. We are very cosmopolitan citizens. And I think a rule change would... It honestly would just legitimize the system. It would legitimize institution on a global level. And you know, it is the way things are, they're becoming out of date very, very fast. They're falling behind very, very fast because this world is becoming smaller and smaller, and the longer that we hold on to the idea that English is all that we need in our lives and all that should be in our lives, you're going to go out there and you're going to find that you are in a very small minority, and that you will be some sort of laughingstock in the world because there are people who graduate high school with 3 or 4 languages under their belt.
Mm-hmm.
They speak them at a near native fluency, and here we are graduating students who, you know, who had to be forced through 4 years of French or Spanish because that's what their high school told them that they needed to graduate, and they don't particularly care about it. And so we're falling behind so fast because we have so many people who don't care because these rules tell them that this is the way the world is, and you can keep living your life like this, and you're gonna be okay. When that is it's just a lie. It really is just a lie. And I think a rule change would wake some people up.
Have you thought about, you know, taking this fight to the NCAA then, trying to get the rule changed? Or has anybody encouraged you to do that?
No. And it honestly hasn't crossed my mind. Because it's tiring, Dan. It's exhausting to even fight for that little piece of your right to exist in your immediate world, in your immediate circle. It's exhausting to go out there and tell, you know, the small sphere of influence that I do have, that this is the world that I exist in, and I just want you to recognize that, because I recognize the world that you exist in, and I've never asked you to step outside of that or confine yourself into a smaller world. And you know, people look at these sorts of issues and they think that it's on me to take it to the NCAA, the national level. And it really shouldn't be on my shoulders, because I'm tired just from writing this article, just from telling the 60-70 acquaintances in my life who care to read the article that this is my life, and this is the rage that I have to tame every single day. And I think that's kind of what my article gets at. That, you know, the only way that we're ever going to have real change is when we stop expecting people who are affected by injustice to step up for themselves, to make changes for themselves. And so, to answer your question, no, I'm not going to take this to the NCAA, because I'm tired. And frankly, I would not have the same weight as, frankly, a white person, a well-educated, well-articulated white person. And you know, I could spend all that time and effort to get their attention, to convince them that this is worth it, to convince them that this is important enough, and they would still not listen to me. And I think that that is, you know, that is a very daunting possibility, and it's a very real possibility. And so, so no, I'm not. But that doesn't mean that I wouldn't support any any change.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just gonna say that, you know, if you're white, you have to recognize the power that's inside of you to change things like this for me, because I'm tired and you're not.
Sure. Well, again, I would encourage everybody to go to the Des Moines Register website and read Brenda's piece. It's very enlightening, I think. And I want to thank Brenda for coming in today. There's a lot of layers to this discussion. I think we could go on for hours, but I don't want to take up any more of your time, Brenda. But I do appreciate you coming in today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
You bet. All right, you've been listening to the Ankeny Fanatic Weekly Podcast, sponsored by Iowa Realty. Iowa Realty is very proud and fortunate to have Home Services Lending, Iowa Title, Midland Title, and Escrow, and Home Services Insurance as part of their one-stop shopping model. They are all able to help you buy and sell anywhere in the state of Iowa. They can also help you, your family, and friends who are moving from anywhere to anywhere in the world through their business affiliates. If you would like information on how to become a realtor, you can call Mike Stanbro at 453-5350, or you can email Mike at mikestanbro, S-T-A-N-B-R-O-U-G-H, at iowarealty.com. I want to thank my guests once again for coming in today, Blaine Hawkins and Brenda Guan. I think it was a really interesting discussion there with Brenda about racism. And hopefully you enjoyed it as well. Come back next week for another edition of the Ankeny Fanatic Weekly Podcast.